brings us to the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. So, Sefer Bamidbar, I want to talk before we actually see the individual content. I wanted to talk about Midbar itself, the significance of the Midbar as the environment in which we function. Each of the Chumashim may be said to have an environment, a specific place in which it takes place. Devarim, well, actually, let's start from the beginning, right? Bereishis is basically Eretz Canaan. More or less, it is in Eretz Canaan. Yes, it's true, you have the opening parashios, which are before, but basically, it's about us getting this land. The is that a shir next door, or is that just a party? Okay, a shir. Okay. But that's Bereishis, right? Shmos, you can make the argument Mitzrayim and then Mishkan. Vayikra is Mishkan, Ohel Moed, Moshe's tent. And then Bamidbar is, gotta be, Midbar. And then Devarim is Abraham Yardin on the brink of entering Israel. Arbos Moav, technically, the plains of Moav. Location is a really important influence in the Torah. It matters. It has standing. The best evidence for this is actually the laws of Shabbos. Masechet Shabbos begins with the laws of Hotzah, of transport on Shabbos, meaning the prohibition against transport from a private domain into a public domain into a private domain. That's the beginning of Masechet Shabbos. In fact, if you learn Mishnayos of Masechet Shabbos, that is the bulk of your Masechet. Meaning if you were to go through all the 24 chapters of Mishnah and ask, what topic had the most text? I believe the answer is transporting things on Shabbos. Because a large chunk of it is just for this type of item, this amount of stuff carries liability. For this type of item, if you carry this amount, you're liable. Here are things you're allowed to transport, here are things you're not allowed to transport, this is considered clothing, this is considered to be a burden, and so on. Tosfos in the beginning of the Masechta asks, why is that the first thing we need to learn about Shabbos? Because the very beginning of the Masechta is this law of transport. Like, I would have thought you should start the Masechta with Kiddush, maybe, right? Or, like, cooking on Shabbos, because that's such a dominant issue. Why did you start with Hotzah, with transport? Take a look on your sheet at source number 6. Tosfos teaches us a lesson. He says, V'nira l'ri, the Ri, one of the authors of the Tosfos, says, it needed to start with the laws of transport because transport is what's called malacha girua. It's a lowly malacha. Meaning, it's not something people think of as malacha. Right? If you tell someone who's not familiar with the laws of Shabbos that walking outside with something in your pocket is a violation of Shabbos, they can't wrap their mind around that. Because we tell everybody that malacha means creative work. And it does. It's a set of tasks involved in creating the Mishkan. It's you know, burning something, building something. It's not walking from point A to point B, and you happen to cross a threshold, and now suddenly you have a problem. Tosfos says, what's the difference between transporting something from a private domain to a public domain and transporting it from a private domain into another private domain? Why is this a malacha? But that's exactly the point. Changing a location does something. Changing a location is not an innocent act. One of the best pieces of evidence for this is the classic. The opening Mishnayos in Masechet Shabbos give illustrations for transport. So if you transport from inside the house to outside the house, or from outside the house to inside the house. But in order to do that, the Mishnah has to name the parties. Right, you can't just say from inside to outside, outside to inside. You have to give me a story. So the story it gives is not Reuven is standing inside, Shimon is standing outside, Reuven hands to Shimon, Shimon hands to Reuven. That's not what it says. It says there's an ani outside, a pauper outside, and there's a balabayas. Right? Balabayas doesn't really need a translation. It's a person who owns a home standing inside. The person who is the balabayas gives food to, gives money to, well, it's not Shabbos, so it's food, to the pauper who's standing outside, or the pauper reaches in and he takes something from the balabais. That's the illustration. Now, it didn't need to give me these names in particular. It could just as easily be, you know, a friend and a friend, or whatever it is. But it labels them because the place where you stand carries the details of your situation in life. The person who's outside is the needy person. The person who has the house is the person who has wealth. Where you are located says something about you. And changing your location is also changing something about you. It's about moving to a new place and, in fact, potentially becoming somebody new. If you think of Lech Lecha, right? Avram has to become somebody different by leaving where he had been. Your location matters. And so Midbar matters, just like all these other locations in the Chumash. And the question is, what does Midbar say about me? If I am located in Midbar, what does that mean about who I am? What would you say?
You're in a place where there's nothing. So you're obviously someone who's either under someone's protection or you're in danger.
Mm-hmm.
You have no resources. There are no natural resources. Can't stay there unless there's somebody taking care of you there.
Right. I mean, we first met Midbar when we crossed through Yam Suf, right? And it was quickly subdued because we got the Mon and we got Miriam's well, right? Hashem tamed Midbar for us, effectively. But as you live in the Midbar, when you get away from Har Sinai, which is what happens in the beginning of Chumash BaMidbar, we set up our camp. You already read in these prakim about setting up the camps and the flags. And then in Parshas Baloscha, we're actually going to leave Har Sinai and start to travel. You can't get away from the fact that you are in a wilderness. And in a wilderness, all artifice is overtaken by nature. All property is now communal. It doesn't. You don't own anything. The Gemara in Nedarim mentions, did I bring it? Yeah, I did bring it on here. The Gemara in Nedarim is commenting on a pasuk at the end of Sefer BaMidbar that's going to talk about the Jews' travels. It says they went from Midbar to Matana, from Matana to Nachliel, from Nachliel to Bamot. So the Gemara there explains each of these names in relation to the Torah. Midbar, Matana, a gift, Nachliel, the Nachala of Hashem, the portion of God. So, as the Gemara says, when one makes himself as a midbar, wilderness, then they get the Torah as a gift. They merit the portion of God. I'm not going into the Gemara and why it does this with the names of those locations. It's an important point, but beyond the scope of what we're going to see right now. My point here is the idea of making yourself as a midbar. That's the idea of humility. That's one of the lessons of Midbar, is to be humble. Another lesson of Midbar is the lesson of isolation, being away from everything else. Ibn Ezra makes a fascinating point in source number 8. He's commenting on the women who came to the Mishkan and donated the mirrors for the Kiyor. So Ibn Ezra says that they said, well, we don't really need anything from this world. We're living in Midbar. So they donate their mirrors to make the kiyor, and they come every day to pray and learn. It was a women's kollel. That's what Ibn Ezra says went on in the Midbar. You're isolated from everything else. You don't need to plant your fields. It won't do you any good. You don't need to maintain anything. God's taking care of it already. There's no purpose to commerce. So Midbar is a lesson in isolation. Midbar is also a place of tabula rasa. It's a blank slate. You can become whoever you want to become, right? There's no incumbent wealth, you know.
There's also no permanency to it. Like,
right.
Desert peoples are nomads. They don't. Nobody wants to own a piece of desert.
Right. Right. What it means is that the Mishkan can be built by two people working together. Who are the ones who build the Mishkan? Bezalel and Aholiyav, right. Bezalel is from?
No, he's the one who's from Yehuda and Aholiyav
is from Dan. Bezalel is from Yehuda, and his grandmother is Miriam. The other one is Aholiyav from Dan. Dan, who comes from Bilhah, right? Rachel's maid. That's the point. You yoke the two of them together to say, anybody can do this. It's a meritocracy. You know, you go out and you do, and you will succeed. That's the idea. And no other biblical environment would suit all of these ends. The humility, the isolation, the tabula rasa. You know, in Canaan, you're among all the Canaanite nations. There's land, as he said, to purchase and to hold and to gain status with. You know, the Mishkan is the opposite of humility. It's this grand location with the embroidery and the gold and everything else. You need the Midbar as a place in which we're going to work through our growing pains, which is exactly what we did in Bamidbar. So that's the prism through which we look at the events that occur in Sefer Bamidbar. But it's not as though we've left the Mishkan behind. In fact, we camp around the Mishkan. Right? And that's what you see in these opening prakim of Bamidbar, where we get this picture of the Jews camping in a great square. Right? You have concentric squares. The Mishkan is in the middle. And then you have Levi camped around it. And around that, you have your four camps, each one having three tribes. And here I wanted to note something. Two different ways to look at a house. You ever have the book, A House is a House for Me?
Yes.
Okay. So, a favorite of children, beautiful illustrations. I never really got it, to be honest. I have it, but I never really got it. But what happens in this book, for those who haven't read it 1,000 times,
we don't have.
Yeah?
I don't.
Okay.
It's a children's book.
Yes.
Somehow I think your kids have to be of a certain... Well, I don't know if your kids are... Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Must have been published around 1985 to 1990 because I had it a long time ago.
Okay. I don't know, but whether kids have it or grandchildren have it, it'll...
In my house, it's been read for more than one generation. Yeah. Anyway,
so... What you get in this book is a depiction of the locations where plants, people, and animals live. This is a house for this kind of creature, this is a house for this kind of creature, this is a house for this kind of creature, and a house is a house for me. You know, that's the basic refrain. But everything is a habitat. No particular bond exists between creature and site. It just, these are all habitats. That's what I get when I read that. And that's one way to look at a house. The other way to look at a house, though, is that it is home with an emotional relationship. Source number 9 I brought you from Professor Rosemary George from University of California. Its importance, the importance of a home, lies in the fact that it is not equally available to all. Home is the desired place that is fought for and established as the exclusive domain of a few. Right? It's ours. The difference is that, yeah, the first view is that home is that a house is an entity. The second is that it's a relationship between the person who lives there and the space itself. The Mishkan in the Prakim that you read has both of those. Take a look at Perek Aleph Pasuk Nun Gimel. It is page 733. The end of the section that has each tribe, counted in the census. The description of the Mishkan there is Mishkan Ha'idut. Right? Mishkan Ha'idut, the place where the testimony, meaning the Luchos, reside. The tablets from Sinai are there. Right? Mishkan Ha'idut. So it is the house for the Luchos. What does it have to do with me? Nothing in particular. It's the place where the Luchos are. But then you go a few psukim later. Perek Bet Pasuk Bet, chapter 2, sentence 2. And what's the description now for it? Now what is it called?
Ohel
Moed. Tent of meeting. Right? Moed is, we use the term both spatially and chronologically, but it's a meeting, it's a gathering. It's, you know, a moed is, like moedim, are the times when everybody gathers together. It's not a space, it's a relationship. This is where we all get together, this is what we do there. so that you're seeing it in terms of the relationship. And the truth is, the Mishkan is both. On the one hand, the Mishkan is the home for Hashem, and the Levim are going to protect it, and they're going to keep everybody else away to make sure that we don't mess up and go in where we're not supposed to go in, or go into the space that we're not supposed to enter. It is, on the one hand, a house. And on the other hand, it's a home. We orient ourselves around the Mishkan. You know, everybody is there with a relationship with the central site where Hashem is located, where, like, you know, the image to me is like flowers turning towards the light. You know, we're all situated around this this place which represents Hashem's presence to us. Is that clear? So we have both sides to it as we camp around it. On the one hand, we're not in it; it's separate, and on the other hand, it's our center. But then you get something odd. You have the census in Perek Aleph, right? And I'm sure you, I'm not sure, I shouldn't say that. The Rashi makes the point about Hashem counting us, He loves counting us, right? Hashem counts us in order to demonstrate His love for us, just like you count all the things that are of value to you, right? That's Rashi in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. So not only are we going to find out who's camping where, but we're going to find out how many of them there are. That was chapter 1. If you didn't fall asleep while reading chapter 1, then you also read chapter 2. And what did you see when you hit chapter 2? Sorry?
The next day.
Right. So you fell asleep, and then you woke up, and then you read. So, chapter 2, we found out who was in which camp. Right? Which Shvatim are going to be together. So, look what happens there. As we count our Shvatim, as we list the Shvatim, we also get an additional piece of information. Right? Take a look on, it's page 733. Chapter 2, sentence 4. Not only are we told that in the first of the Shvat, of the Degalim, you're going to get Yehuda, right? Led by Nachshon ben Aminadav, but you're also told how many people are in Yehuda, right? In chapter 2, sentence 3, sentence 4, we are told that there are 74,600 people in Yehuda, right? Go back now, please, to chapter 1, sentence 27. How many people are in Yehuda?
74,600.
Yeah, 74,600. That's going to be true for all of these. There's no discrepancy. So my question to you is, why? Why'd you bring the number again? It was bad enough we had them the first time. Why do we need to bring the numbers all over again? One chapter later, what did you accomplish? No, did that bother anybody while reading these brachim? Or was it just like, okay, here's another piece of information? It's very odd.
Well,
yeah.
And I'm just like, the first count is specifically, I mean, I know the numbers are the same, but it's, refers to them as their fighting strength. And the second count refers to them by their encampment. So you get the number, not just of the tribe, but of the Dego. So you get the size of each encampment.
But then wouldn't you have different numbers?
You mean the number for each set of three tribes?
Well, you know, the Mishkan's in the middle, and there's, you know, Degel, Yehuda is on one side, and yeah, that each side's total is given.
Right.
So I figured that, you know, you need to know the size of the encampments. What struck me is that the tribes are not evened up.
Correct.
That there's a very big one and a very little one, and two that are about the same.
Right. And that's something we're going to have to hit. That's going to matter. So it's true that the number is going to be significant, but it's odd that I'm going to break it down by Shevet and not just by here's one group of three, here's one group of three, here's one group of three. Let me give you the numbers, you know, for each collective. So, yeah.
The Ramban, if you
yeah.
It says here, this was just now I was looking at it, says that it was miraculous that no one died during that.
Right. Time. So Ramban, I think, I saw it in Rabbeinu B'chayim. I didn't see it in Ramban. They credit it to Ramban?
They credit to Ramban here.
Okay. Maybe
so I would also add that no one was born then, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, then they could.
Or
they count
yeah.
them between, only yeah. The count the ones who are eligible to go to the army. So. Nobody born wouldn't matter.
Right. Except for under 20.
No, but those who would have aged in or aged out.
Yeah, that's true.
But yes, I saw it as Rabbeinu B'chaye. I thought I looked at Ramban and didn't see it there. But yes, that's one idea. Is to say there are no deaths in the 3-week period from when they first did a census to when they started traveling.
Well, that's not also, if you're talking about people who are going to the army, you're not expecting that those numbers are going to shift. Like, say, you're not even talking about births, but if deaths, like those,
right.
if there's not a war going on, you're not expecting that those people are going
right.
to be the ones.
We would be surprised to see that.
Yeah.
Because they're miraculous that they all survived. Yes and no. I mean, once you get to large scale numbers, it can happen. But Abarbanel has a fascinating explanation, which Malbim then summarizes. But I brought you the Abarbanel in source number 11. I was putting together the sheet in an airport, and I was very tired. And I said, you know what, I don't know if we're going to get this far, so I didn't translate it. I apologize. But I did underline so that you'd catch the main points, and we'll go through it now. This is the Abarbanel's comment here. He loves stuff like this. He says, nearly, it appears to me, he says, the question really is, why is it that the tribes are assigned to the flags to which they are assigned? Is there rhyme or reason in terms of who is where? Now, the truth of the matter is, there is rhyme or reason. It's very clear. In the sense that the first two, the Galim, are all Leah's kids. Right? The first six ones are all Leah's kids. And then after that, it's Rachel, Bilhah, Zilpah. Everybody else in the latter two. What he means is, I don't think what he's asking is in terms of why they are in their Degalim, but why this one is on this side, why that one is on that side. Is it by chance, or is it intentional? And so he says, the numbers demonstrate what the intent is. He says, if you see my first underline, he says the first camp is the one that's in danger in a time of war, that's most in danger. Right? Keeping in mind that as they travel, he's taking the view that the one that's listed first is going to be the lead. Because there are two different views about how that worked when they traveled. And you'll see this when you get to Baal Oscha. One view is they travel in the square, and the other view is that they travel in a line. That they actually break out of this square pattern, and then it's 1, 2, Mishkan, 3, 4. So he's taking that view. So he says, your first one then is the one that's most in danger. And therefore, he says, this is very funny, French speakers will like this. He says, he says, you put the mightiest in the first camp. To the point where people who speak languages other than Hebrew will call the first group avant-garde. That's what he writes.
Wow.
Yep. The Rotzalomar Shetzarich Ma'od L'Shomra. This is the one that has to guard. That's why you have Yehuda first with Yisachar and Zebulun. Why? Because he says once you count them up, you recognize this is the largest group. So the idea is that they're the ones who should be first. Then he says, the second part that I underlined, he says, the one who's in the back is the one who is next most vulnerable. Because maybe the enemy will come and attack from behind. He mentions Amalek attacking those who are at the back. And so he says, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali are at the back because they're the second largest of the groups. And then he says, the north and the south, those are the ones who aren't in as much danger, and therefore those are the smaller camps. That's the way that he looks at it. So he says, the reason why it's counted again is in order to highlight that the way that it's designed. Okay. Last point. Perek Gimel in Bamidbar. Right? So we've learned about Midbar. And we see that we're camped around the Mishkan. On the one hand, we're not in it, it's a house. It's not really our home, but on the other hand, we feel like it's our home, and therefore we're all focused on it and centered around it. And they arrayed around it, I should say. And then we saw the arrangement into the camps and why we're in these particular alignments. And then in Perek Gimel, we get the appointment of the Levium to replace the firstborn. And we find out that there is a redemption to be done. So then, if you take a look at Perek Gimel, Pasuk Mem Daled, chapter 3, sentence 44, it's page 743. Hashem says to Moshe, take the Levium in place of all of the firstborn, take the animals of the Levium in place of their animals, right? And the Levium are all going to serve me. And then we have a problem because there are some extra firstborns who don't have parallel Levium. So take 5 shekel per firstborn and give it as a gift to Aaron and his kids. Right? Those Bechorim, those firstborn who don't have a Levi for an exchange, so they should instead pay 5 coins. Okay, what's the problem with this? Those who are doing 929 should know that there is a problem with this. The problem is that this isn't new. We knew this mitzvah already. If you go back to Shmos Perek Yud Beis, the end of Parshas Bo, not Perek Beis, Perek Gimel, I apologize. It is page 365 in particular. It tells you, B'chol b'chor adam d'vanecha tifteh. Redeem all the firstborn. It says to redeem the firstborn animals, and it says to redeem the firstborn people. So why did you not know all of this? Why did we need it as a new command in Bamidbar chapter 3? I saw that in Shmos Perek Gimel. So one resolution of this is to say that two different things have to happen. In Shmos Perek Yud Gimel, it's about dedicating and mitigating. I'm sorry, it's about mitigating. Well, it is dedicating also. It's dedicating the Bechorim, the firstborn, as holy, because it begins, Kadesh Li Kol Bechor, sanctify all the firstborn. And then it's about mitigating it. You're going to have to redeem them so that they can do something other than holy work. The focus is what you do to the firstborn. So first is, identify them as holy. Why? Because Hashem killed the firstborn in Egypt and He saved your firstborn. So therefore, dedicate them to Hashem. And then do something to them, redeem them, because otherwise you can't use them for anything. How are you going to tell them to take out the trash? They're holy to God. So you better do something that's going to redeem them. But what's missing there is it doesn't say where the Kedusha goes. It doesn't say, it just says that you should redeem them. It doesn't say who's getting the money. That only comes about in the Prakim that you read. Now we find out who's receiving the money, which is Shevet Levi, because they're the ones who are going to become holy. Why couldn't Shevet Levi receive the money initially? They hadn't been designated. What was it that gave them their designation? The Egel, right. The aftermath of the Egel. When they didn't serve and they were involved in punishing those who had served the golden calf, that's when they became the ones who would be the recipients of this money of redemption. So Ramban writes on Bamidbar Perek Gimel that now the Kohanim are ready and we can complete the mitzvah instruction. I brought you the Nitziv in source number 12, who puts it very succinctly. He says, He says the redemption in Parshas Bo was only to allow them to do mundane things, but they were still going to be the Kohanim. And it only changes afterwards. So what I think is important about this is it teaches us something about Pidyon HaBen. Meaning Pidyon HaBen is not actually about exchanging the baby for the five coins. That's not really what it's about. it's really a reenactment of the original identification of Kedusha that you found in Parshas Bo. The sanctification that occurred in Parshas Bo is what we are doing. We're declaring them to be holy, and then separate from that, and now there's money that's going to the Kohanim because the Torah says that we do that. But you're really trying to do is to declare to Hashem, the firstborn are holy. Thank you for saving them in Mitzrayim. That's the idea. You follow? I said it a little quickly because we're at the end. But okay, so hopefully this gave you a little bit more to go with your 5 o'clock this week.